Hello and welcome to Playback Daily for Monday, the 15th of April. I'm Louise Herity and here's some of what's coming up.
We all have narcissistic traits and some are healthier than the others. And that healthy narcissism is what makes you ambitious, get ahead and achieve things. And unhealthy narcissism is the total opposite because that person intends to cause harm or hurt people.
Think about where your child's going to go to college, if you can think that far in advance. And some people are lucky, like they're living in Cork or they're living in Galway, they're living in Dublin, and there's a couple of places to choose from for third level education. But other people, there will be no choice. The child will have to travel and you need to build that into your costs.
Okay. As a woman, I love being single. I would say I'm probably one of the happiest divorced women on the planet.
Oliver Callum was joined by Helen Villiers and Katie McKenna, psychotherapists and authors of You're Not the Problem, a book dealing with the impact of narcissism and emotional abuse and how to heal.
Good morning.
And I'm going to start with you, Helen, okay. If that's okay.
Yeah.
So in the introduction of the book, and it is a fantastic book, almost so detailed that we'd have to go back to it time and time again. But you're saying that we kind of only learn about the impact of physical abuse in the 70s, then the 90s we learned about the impact of sexual abuse. And now this is new, the impact of emotional abuse and particularly narcissism. It is relatively new to us, isn't it?
Well, I think it's new to the wider population, but I think as psychotherapists, we've been understanding it for quite a long time. And the thing to recognise is that emotional abuse is the cornerstone of all abuse. Mm-hmm. So physical and sexual abuse can't exist without emotional abuse. Because say, for example, I went on a date and on that date, someone on the first date, they punched me in the face. I'm going to report them to the police. I'm never going to see them again. It's all going to be like saying to my friends, oh my God, can you believe they did that to me? And then if I was going on the 20th date and I've had all this behaviour that we describe in You're Not the Problem, if we go on the 20th date and I've been love bombed and trauma bonded and they punch me in the face, I'm going to find a way to justify it. I'm going to excuse it. And that's what emotional abuse does. It creates an environment where all the other abuses can exist, but on its own can be a thing too.
So that was a one-off. They're not usually like this. Maybe I did something to provoke
I've
it.
Provoked it. You
find blaming yourself and all those kind of things.
Absolutely.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? And it's just literally a timeline.
Yeah.
And you're describing a lot of domestic violence, which we've covered on this show quite a bit as well. But we're talking about the impact on parents, narcissistic parents, on their children in particular this morning, aren't we? So there are five main traits of narcissism.
There are five main traits of narcissism. They are grandiosity, entitlement, exploitation, motivational empathy and impaired self-awareness.
Okay. Yeah. So we share these out among the team that you have here today. Grandiosity, you'd expect that straight away. So this is, I'm the greatest, everyone is, I'm better than everyone. Is that the sort of...
Yeah.
Yeah. Grandiosity would be the big I am. They would be showboating. You know, you can recognise them. They're better than everyone else. And more with the covert or the more insidious is even if, you know, somebody has a pain in their head, the grandiosity trait is, well, that my pain in my head was worse than yours. If you have a pain in your stomach, mine was always worse. So there's never any space for you in it. It's all about them. They are the sun and they think the world revolves around them.
Okay. Entitlement then?
Well, entitlement is that I want it, so I'll get it and I'll have it. And there's a thing that we have to remember that these can be healthy. So we can have these traits healthily, but it's where they're toxic and they're hurting people. Mm-hmm. So the entitlement trait is a really good example of that. I want that job. I'm going to climb over whoever I want to get that promotion or job. And therefore, I don't care who I'm hurting to get it. But whereas if it was healthy, it would be, I'm going to work for it. I'm going to earn it. You know, it's that I'm entitled to be promoted because I work hard and I'm good at what I do.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's just trampling over people. But as I said, they can be healthy. Are all of these put together, are they the kind of sign of a narcissist or can you have just one or two of them? We've got entitlement, exploitation again, which is obviously...
Exploitation is... hard for people to recognise when it is in the parent-child relationship because they are brought up with this. They think that it's normal. Mm-hmm. So what we would see with exploitation in the parent-child relationship is where the child would be encouraged and conditioned to go out to work early so that the parents can take money from them, you know, at such a young age where it's really inappropriate, where the parent can lean on the child emotionally and exploit the relationship.
Right.
So again, it's all about them. They want this for their own personal gain.
But it could be sold as, oh, we want to make the child independent and a go-getter or so on.
Yeah, you've got it, yeah.
But I mean, totally exploited by the parent along the way. Motivational empathy.
It's my favourite one, right, which I know sounds a bit weird, doesn't it? So motivational empathy, there's a really big misconception in narcissistic personality disorder or just any of these behaviours that there's a complete lack of empathy, and that's actually not true at all. Mm. What there is impaired empathy, and motivational empathy specifically. So it's making you feel bad for either holding someone accountable. So, oh, I'm just the worst person ever. I shouldn't be like your partner, or I'm the worst mother in the world. Or it's making you feel bad for calling them out and making you do things against your will because you feel obliged, fear, obligation and guilt. Yeah.
And that just goes on and on and on.
On and on and on.
So is it sort of empathy for themselves or trying to feel the other person feel guilty? Is it sort of pulling on the heartstrings?
Pulling on the heartstrings, guilt tripping. Yeah. It's eliciting the other person's empathy and their guilt for the narcissistic's own personal gain. So they will make you feel bad for holding them accountable or make you feel responsible if they want something. So guilt tripping and pulling on the heartstrings is what people might know as motivational empathy.
And just to complete the full bingo card of narcissism, impaired self-awareness.
Impaired self-awareness. Again, massive misconception that there's a complete lack of self-awareness. Mm-hmm. But what it actually is I know that if I do this behaviour, I will get this thing and I will have that need met. So I can exploit you to get that thing and that I feel entitled to. But if I... If I look at my behaviour, if I want to know why I'm doing that, I can't do that as the narcissist, you know?
And as Helen said at the beginning, we all have narcissistic traits and some are healthier than the others. And that healthy narcissism is what makes you ambitious, get ahead and achieve things. Mm. And unhealthy narcissism is the total opposite, because that person intends to cause harm or hurt people. They will use you to get ahead. They'll walk all over you or climb all over you to get ahead. They tell you that they have your best interests at heart, but they don't. And with unhealthy narcissism, you're never taken into consideration because it's all about them.
Okay, so you're thinking of trying to win your Olympic medal this summer in Paris. Mm-hmm. It's healthy, obviously, to say, I am the best, I'm going to be best in the world and so on. But if you're willing to trample over everyone in your life to get there, that's going to be the unhealthy element to it. Can you be one of these things, or is it generally a combination of multiples or all of them?
In order to be kind of considered as having NPD, first of all, a psychiatrist or a psychologist has to diagnose that. There are a number of traits that they would look for in behaviours. But when we reduce it down, these five main traits are the things that we are kind of looking for as a whole. So we'd really want to be seeing all of them together if we're thinking someone is narcissistic.
To identify that. Now, we're talking as though we're trying to identify someone out there going, am I a narcissist? But this is, and all your experience as psychotherapists are dealing with the children of narcissistic parents, presumably as adults when they grow up and go through their lives and suddenly discover very late perhaps that what they've gone through. Is that your experience?
Yes. And with the social media, with the knowledge, we're seeing people a lot younger recognise this. Before this, myself and Helen talked typically we would have seen people in their 40s, 50s recognising this, and now we see it younger. And there's two main things we look for, and that's hyperdependence and hyperindependence. And there's three questions that you should ask yourself. For hyperindependence, do you find it difficult to trust people? Do you find it difficult to ask for help? Do you keep people at arm's length? And if the answer is yes to those three questions, there's a strong chance there's hyperindependence there. And for hyperdependence, do you find it difficult to say no? Do you constantly try to please others? And do you find yourself apologising all the time? And if the answer is yes to those three questions, there's a strong chance there's hyperdependence there.
So they seem like two completely different things, but they're traits of the same person who suffered.
And you're right, it seems like two completely different things, but the motivation from all these behaviours is to protect you from getting hurt.
Okay. So people come to you, and I noticed that you dedicated the book to all the adult children of narcissistic parents. You're saying to them, you're not the problem, as the book says.
You're not the problem. When you grow up in these environments, you are taught that you are the problem. You're constantly being told the reason that you're the problem in this relationship is because of your behaviour, the way you are, your character, morally corrupt, that there's something really wrong with you.
Okay.
And you genuinely believe that. Like, growing up in that environment, the clients that we see have this core belief that they are absolutely fundamentally flawed, beyond help, unable to be loved, and don't deserve to be either. And so they are, yeah, absolutely, you're not the problem. It is really making that statement to reinforce that idea.
Does it take a long time to convince a patient that this is what they're suffering?
It would be clients that we would see, and this is not about convincing at all. This is about hearing somebody's story. And although everybody's lived experience will be different, again, myself and Helen see this pattern linked back to childhood. And another way that we talk about this, and you're not the problem, is to identify the roles in the family systems. So there's four roles that we will see, and that's the golden child, and everybody knows a golden child. Yeah, this is the child that the, you know, the parent idealizes and pedestals and thinks that they're perfect. They're not, but in the parents' eyes, they are. Mm-hmm. There's the scapegoat child, and they're blamed for absolutely everything that goes wrong within the family.
Yeah.
There's the invisible child, and that's exactly that. They're invisible. Nobody sees them. They're just completely ignored. They're forgotten.
Are they usually the middle child? Isn't that what the middle child will often say about themselves?
The middle child syndrome. But often we see that the middle child is normally the scapegoat, actually.
Is that right?
Really,
okay.
Yeah,
not
typically,
the invisible
yeah.
one. Okay.
Yeah, it's always quite... I mean, look, nobody knows. What we very often see is that the golden child is the oldest boy when the narcissistic parent is a mother. And
right.
Yeah, and that will be...
And it's a daughter if the narcissistic parent is a father?
No, not necessarily.
Oh.
And so with fathers, it's less predictable, but with mothers, it's very predictable. And that, I mean, look, we could go into patriarchy and all that kind of stuff,
okay.
But maybe not the right time and place. But yeah, there's a whole thing about boys having more value.
And there was one other role there, the fourth, the gilded child. And we see a lot of these in therapy because these children can think that they're the golden child. And from the outside, they may look like that, but they have to work really hard to be the best friend to their parent. They have to grow up really quickly
right.
to maintain this position.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting because obviously we can understand the suffering of the scapegoat and the invisible child, but the golden child doesn't necessarily have it all easy either.
No,
they definitely don't. And I think that can be a misconception from people because for the siblings of the golden child, they will feel very resentful towards the golden child because they get away with everything. We would hear people say, oh, they'd get away with murder. You know, they're never held accountable. And already we can see the disservice the parent is doing to the relationships because these children, there will be such resentment. They won't be able to have healthy relationships with their siblings. And then because they're not held accountable, we see these people then growing up with such an unhealthy sense of entitlement, and then they can enter into relationships. So if we use that example of the eldest boy, they can enter into relationships then where they want a mother for a partner instead of an equal partner where they're there to support.
And they become quite toxic too, unfortunately.
Right. Someone's already asking here, lots of questions coming in.
Ooh.
Can you ask, does narcissism affect siblings? So I presume this is where there's a narcissistic sibling, not the parent.
Well, this is the thing that people find very difficult, is that when there is a narcissistic sibling, there will have been a narcissistic parent.
Really?
It's very, very unlikely. Unless, and so I need to always give a little caveat, that there's some kind of influence outside of the family that has been very present. So lots and lots of bullying in very early childhood, or, I don't know, abuse in early childhood from a non-parent. That might create the narcissistic sibling, but... Typically what we see is that the narcissistic sibling is the golden child and that they have got a narcissistic parent, and people hate it because it's brutal.
Because then you've got two of them to deal with. The characteristics of a narcissistic parent, in the book it's 2.5 pages long. Mm. There's a long, long list of things.
There is.
I mean, is there any way on radio of summing up the characteristics of the narcissistic parent?
Oh, well, somebody who's extremely entitled. So they feel like they should know they should be the first one to know all the news. They should be the one that has all the power, all the control. You're not allowed relationships that they don't know about, or they're in all of your business. I mean, we've got three different types of parents, which is the critical, the engulfing, the ignoring, and the fourth one is the combination. Right? So critical parent being very critical, and they're just like not afraid to tell you that they don't like what you're wearing, or that they think you're too fat, or, you know, they're really very, very critical. Then we've got the ignoring parent, literally the same thing. They just don't care. They're not involved. They probably don't know what you do for a job. They don't ring you unless you ring them. They've got no interest at all. Then the engulfing parent, who is the one who is in all of your business. You know, they want to know absolutely everything you're doing. They're really the one that would read your diary. They're all over the place. And then, of course, the combination who is all of those things.
Helen Villiers and Katie McKenna, authors of You're Not the Problem. And you can hear the full interview on the RTE Radio app. Many Leaving Cert students are making their final CAO choices over the next few weeks, an anxious time for them, but also bringing a lot of financial concern for both the students and their parents, something Claire Byrne discussed with Owen McGee, financial planner and author of How to Make Your Money Work.
And Owen, this has been, for a very long time, a period of stress for people looking at, you know, how much is this going to cost? Have I saved enough or I haven't saved at all?
Yeah, and it is big stress. It's a big cost. Like, if you look at the most recent figures that we would use in private practice, and they're publicly available, it's €13,305 per year per child. Uh-huh. That assumes that the child lives away from home. You can knock about €6,000 or €7,000 off that figure per year if the child lives at home. Mm-hmm. So it is an incredibly expensive time, and it is one of those ones that can kind of creep up on you. Like, the first 10 years of your child's life seem to disappear, and then you go into a different phase, and then all of a sudden they're going to college and you're going, oh, okay, I should have really been prepared for this
financially.
It feels
like a very long time away, and then suddenly it isn't.
It just creeps up on you.
So just go back over those numbers again. So if the child is living out of the home, you're looking at what, about
13,000 euros, €13,305.
And then if they're living at home, about half that.
You take about €6,000 or €7,000 off it, which is basically rent and a few other bits, but you take about €6,000 or €7,000 off that. And that's, remember, that's averages, because I will sometimes be sitting in front of a client and say, I know I have a child in college and it's cost me less than that. Or some people say, I have a child in college and that doesn't cover anywhere near it. So they're the average numbers that are out there. So just be careful. Think about where your child's going to go to college, if you can think that far in advance. And some people are lucky, like they're living in Cork or they're living in Galway, they're living in Dublin, and there's a couple of places to choose from for third level education. But other people, there will be no choice. The child will have to travel, and you need to build that into your costs.
Okay, so there is help available, though. Yeah. We have a grants system in this country. How does that process work?
So one of the things I will say about the Susie Grant is what it is. If you have a look at it online, the website itself is actually really good. It's really informative. It's very easy to find the information that you want to find out. In terms of what's available, there's a couple of criteria. You need to be living in the country for more than 3 years, or in EU or Switzerland or the UK. In fact, there's an arrangement there as well. So you need to be 3 years or more here, more or less, in Europe. Then you need to be going to an approved course. So the course, obviously, there's certain courses will be approved. Again, a list of them are up there. You also need to be progressing with your education. So if you're going back the Susie Grant, so say you did a year or two of one thing and now you're going back to start something else completely, just be careful at that progression thing. And then it comes down to means and how much you're on. There's two kind of criteria, or two kind of ways it's split out. One is mature students living away from home, and then others is actually kids who are still living at home, even if they are mature. And that's just determining whose income's being assessed. So it's always the individual's income if they've income in their own right. But then is it that person and their parents, or that person and someone who they cohabit with or are married to?
That'll just depend on your circumstances.
And it gets very, very complicated. It depends how many kids there are in the house. Depends how many years your course is going to be. It depends on a whole pile of things. But the top end of it would be a subsidy or a grant of somewhere about €10,000. Now, that's split between a monthly amount that's paid to you in terms of a maintenance fee over 9 months, and then a contribution towards your fees and a couple of other bits. So it's kind of split. And that's the top end of it. And then the bottom end of it is €500. And the salary scale for that is somewhere between 26,000 to the top end, right the way up to 100,000 plus if it's just the €500 that you're getting.
So everybody should check out if they're eligible for anything, because you'll need it.
And there's a really easy calculator to use on the Susie website. It works. I played with it this morning and it works really simple. It's very straightforward. Mm-hmm. I'll give you a quick idea whether you will be entitled to something or not.
Okay, now let's go to some questions from a Sligo listener. Wanted some advice on how to set up an education fund for our grandson. Now, he's less than one, so they're getting in early. You approve of that, I know, from the get-go. We've been having trouble setting up a fund or account for him, which we can add to each month, and that he will then have access to at 18. This is to cover college or whatever he wants to do.
OK, so this is for their grandson, is that what they said at the start? OK, so the first thing to say is, it's interesting, because a parent can give a child €335,000 in their lifetime, and there's no problem with gift from that perspective. There's no tax. Grandparents, it drops down to €32,500. So the grandparents can give €32,500 during their lifetime. Interestingly enough, if I pay for my child's education, it doesn't come out of that €335,000. But if granny and granddad pay for the child's education, I'd suggest it does. So what these people need to be careful of is how they set up the account. They need to set it up in such a way that they use up, in any year, any person can give €3,000 to any other person in the state. So I can give you €3,000, Claire, and there's no tax implications, mm-hmm. provided we do it within the calendar year. So granny or granddad or granny and granddad can give it to the grandson, and provided it doesn't break €3,000 from granny and €3,000 from granddad, which is €6,000, well, then there'll be no tax implications whatsoever. But so we would set up a specific account in the child's name, even though they're only one, and the money will go to them. And when they turn 18, they'll be able to access that money, even if granny and granddad don't want them to have it anymore. But the reason why I brought the 335 into it is I don't want parents going that route when it's to pay for college. Because if it's a parent saving for college, the parent saves for it in their own name, because when they use it for college, it won't come out of the 335 allowance.
So it's really important to mention that. I wonder why they say they've been having trouble setting up a funder account for him.
There's a couple of things. First of all, it could be maybe they're trying to keep it quiet from him. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing. But you're going to have to just suck it up there, because you do want to make sure that the account is set up in their names to use up that annual gift allowance. You put it in the child's name. It has to be in the child's name. Sometimes it depends on where you're trying to set up. Some banks may not be able to do it. But one of the other points I would make here is that child is one. That's a long term goal. Don't use a short term vehicle for a long term goal. A short term vehicle is a bank account, on post or credit union account. Use a long-term vehicle for a long-term goal, not a short-term vehicle. What's a long-term vehicle? You need to invest it. Because if you don't invest it, and I'm talking about scary stuff that people often run away from, like shares and things like that. If you don't invest it, you are not going to keep pace with inflation. And you're really going to have to put significantly more in on a month-to-month basis to try and make a decent contribution towards college, or you're just going to fall short.
Okay, so can we come to people who are in a fortunate enough position to be able to save in just a moment? The people who are caught short now in September and just don't have the money and need the money.
Yes.
Panic, produce the credit card. I know you're going to say don't do that.
Yeah.
But say you do need to borrow, like, what do you do?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't borrow the credit card. Like, the easiest way to get a loan is always the most expensive. So credit cards are really easy. Yeah. You tap them, you've got the loan in your pocket straight away, done. And that's typically up to 22.9%. And that's very expensive, okay? Mm-hmm. And so you need to just take a step back. And if you're looking at it already and you're saying, in August, I'm going to need to borrow money, start the process now. Doing anything between now and September is better than doing August or September is better than doing nothing. But then shop around for the loan. Try and figure out, the more time you have to figure out, is it going to be the credit union? Is it going to be your bank? Where's the best place to borrow it? And if you're borrowing for the first year's fees, let's assume you're borrowing €13,000 to cover the first year in full. Try, if you can at all, borrow it over 6 months, not 12 months. Now, this is ideal, right? But anything is better than nothing. If you borrow over 6 months, you pay it back over 6 months, and then you save for the second 6 months, so you're not borrowing next year again. Now, even if it's 11 months, even if it's 10 months, if it's anything less than 12 months, what you're doing is you're making the problem next year a little bit less than it would have been if you had it borrowed over 12 months and had to borrow again immediately.
I see what you mean.
And that applies exactly the same when we're standing in the schoolyard in secondary and primary school. If you're next September, if the figures remain the same from last year, next September, if you're standing in the schoolyard and you've got two parents standing beside mm-hmm. you and you haven't borrowed, one of the other two have, because one in three people will borrow for back to school. And what I would try and do is just cut down how long the loan is so that you can save the rest of the time that you have left before you have to borrow again.
So we mentioned people who can save, and I have somebody in touch with us who is putting aside the child benefit for the two young children that they have, so that they will have a pot of money when they're older. Currently we have it in the credit union, but the return is terrible. Have you any advice for where to put it? That is a great position that they're in if they can do that.
Yep.
And we understand not everybody can, but what should they be doing with that money?
Yeah, we understand that not everybody can do that. The other thing I'd say is if you can't do it, there's no guilt in the fact that you spend the children's allowance or child benefit on the kids. That's what you were given it for, is to spend it on the kids. So if you're in the lucky position, you're able to put it away. probably the biggest mistake I see new clients coming to me with is that they are doing exactly what that person's doing. And it's back to what I said a second ago. We're using a short-term vehicle for a long-term goal. Credit union is a short-term vehicle. So is Ampost. So is a bank account. And what you're doing there is you're making your life harder. And let's just run the maths here just very quickly, Claire. If you put €140 a month aside for 18 years, let's ignore tax, right? And you put it aside for 18 years. In 18 years' time, if you manage to get 1% a year out of the bank on average, you're going to end up with just over €33,000 in your bank account. OK, that's if you did it for the entire life of the child and they're going to college on their 18th yeah. birthday, 33,000. Remember, it's €13,000 a year. We're not getting to the end of third year here with that 33,000, right? If you invest it and you put it into, we'll come back to what type of investment in one second. If you invest and you get 4%, you're up to just over 44,000.
Big difference.
I handpicked, but I did the opposite. I didn't handpick. I randomly picked a fund that was available to one of Irish investors in 2006. When I saw it was 2006, 18, people who were born in 2006 or 18 this year, right? It was 2006. Oh my God. But the 2006 to today, €66,000. You just need to make sure your money is working as hard as you are to get it.
Okay.
Get it working hard.
Financial planner Owen McGee on Today with Claire Byrne. On Sunday with Miriam yesterday, the host was joined by singer and violin player with The Corrs, Sharon Corr, who now lives in Madrid. And Sharon started by telling Miriam what that's like.
Well, it's a lot drier. Yeah, a lot more sun. I love Madrid. It's a very beautiful cultural city, plenty of great museums. And, you know, if you just walk, it's like a walking art gallery. Yeah. And you can be out in the terraces having a beer or whatever and some nice tapas all year round. So I fell in love with it in the late 90s. Basically made my decision while I was out promoing with The Corrs in Spain. I went, I'm going to have to live here at some stage. So I moved 6 years ago.
Your two children, of course, they're teenagers now, aren't they?
Yeah.
How old are your son and your daughter? How old are they?
Well, Cal just turned 18 last week. Flory,
he's an adult.
He's an adult. And it's like, you know, I know he was waiting to pounce. You know, it was this sort of thing where it was like all of a sudden, he was just waiting for the moment where he could say, you actually can't tell me what to do anymore, can you? And I'm like, no, I can't. So you're making your own decisions, but you're going to be responsible for them as well. Just remember, I'm paying the bills
yeah.
for the moment, you know. So, and my daughter Flory turns 17 in July.
Oh, they're beautiful ages.
They're lovely. Challenging. You've got enough children as well, don't you? So
lovely. Challenging.
It's like something else, isn't it?
Do you mind going right back for my listeners this
sure.
morning, Sharon? Remind us where you grew up and about your mum and dad. They were super musical themselves,
yeah.
weren't they?
Yeah, we grew up in Dundalk. Mum and dad are both from Dundalk. Their family heritage would be Tyrone and Donegal. Dad worked as an accountant in the ESB in Dundalk, and mum was a stay-at-home mum until she said, that's enough of that, and I'm going out to work because I'm making my own money. And she, one thing that she always said to us girls was, make your own money. And I've always stood mm-hmm. by it, and I firmly believe in it. So yeah, so we went there. Apart from, you know, the day jobs, their greatest love in life was music, and it was actually something that they had in common. So they had a band together. So they made the extra money just to get the new bathroom or to get a, you know, washing machine and all that sort of stuff when we were growing up, by making music at the weekends. And they found the magic in their life mm-hmm. doing that together, being creative, you know, which is where the magic is in my life. So we were brought up surrounded by music, and you know, that was the whole naissance of everything, you know.
And of course, there's you and Caroline
yeah.
and Andrea and Jim.
Yeah.
But do you mind me asking, there was another little boy, Jared, wasn't
That's
there?
That's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're going to get me crying, but because actually it was Dad's anniversary just the other day. But yes, we had a brother, Jared, and his anniversary wasn't that long ago. Actually, it was in April. So he died when he was four years old. And I was basically just brought home from hospital, for my mother had just had me as a newborn baby. And unfortunately, he was killed on the road in front of our house by a car going by. So, yeah, tragic beginnings.
And did your parents talk about Jared much, or was one of those things that...
It was something that would... would come out sort of unexpectedly. They had to be very strong for us, and indeed very strong for each other. Because can you imagine keeping a marriage together with that? I mean, they do say that most people lose their marriages through the death of a child. And my parents didn't. Every so often I'd find Mum, you know, with a jumper that she'd knitted for Jared, and she'd be touching it, and, you know, and I'd find her in a sort of stolen moment, you know. Mm-hmm. And Dad too, you know, every so often. I guess it's like one of the great, I suppose you would have to call it a great fundamental and terrible fundamental, but possibly of the course, you know, because that was our brother. And apparently he was extremely talented, you know, loved music. So we thought he would have been the bass player because we were missing a bass player.
Probably would have been.
Yeah.
So were you always going to be in a band? Like, how did that begin?
Well, we weren't always going. I mean, I guess we were. You know, if you believe in destiny and fate, I guess we were. But we didn't know that. But we were brought up in so much music. We were following our separate courses. I was in the Junior Irish Youth Orchestra and you know, so playing classical music, undisciplined as I was. Caroline and Andrea were learning piano. Caroline's 3 years younger than me and Andrea 4. And Jim's 6 years older, so we have that gap then because of Jared. And Jim was out pursuing a musical career, so he was playing with the Fountainhead and Dolores Keane and different people like that. And Jim was recording people. He was a real tech individual, you know, so he was recording different people. And he was recording this guy called John Hughes, who is an artist, who then became our manager.
Great guy.
Fantastic guy. It just grew from that. It was the casting director, Ross Hubbard, had said when we were auditioning for The Commitments, you guys should be a band and he should be your manager. And that was it. Then I think the beautiful thing was that our parents were very unique in their outlook, as that they weren't so terrified of the sharks in the industry that they didn't want us to reach for the stars.
And your dad apparently always believed you would get to the stars.
And my dad said, you're going to rule the world.
But for instance, that song, Runaway.
Yeah.
I remember 95 dancing around with my little girls in rooms. Everyone loved that song. The genesis of that, how did that come about? Is it right that you just heard Andrea one day tinkling something on the piano?
Close.
Okay.
Okay, so I think I was down in the kitchen and Andrea was upstairs, and we had my grandmother's piano, which was violently out of tune. But that's what we grew up on. And it was in Jim's bedroom. And Caroline was up playing around with something on the piano, and I heard this and it sounded really, really, really beautiful. And I kind of started humming to it, and I went upstairs, and then I sort of wrote a set of terrible lyrics to it. And then Andrea came upstairs, and then she started working on it. And it sort of, it came about just very naturally. And the curious thing about it, and this seems to happen to an awful lot of bands, it's the last song on a record is the first song out. It's really, really curious. And you don't even think you're going to put the song on the record. We had never pitched this song to David Foster, who became our producer, because it wasn't finished. One day, I don't know, maybe Jim was in the studio or something, I don't know what it was, and David Foster walked into the house that we were living in, and he goes, what's that, you know? And we went, oh, well, this is just, you know, like something. And then Jim started playing along to it. And then he did that change at the end where it goes from minor to major.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's sort of like, it's a lovely lilt on it.
And David Foster said, I love it.
He said, well, that's going on the album.
Was that song the beginning of your huge success?
I guess because it was the first song out, yes. But the one that got us the first sort of push over the hill, sort of, if you know what I mean, when you're sort of, you're sort of climbing and you're climbing and you're, you know, nobody's noticing and you've got these this album out. And so we were asked by a guy in Atlantic Records to contribute a song to a tribute record of Fleetwood Mac. And Dreams was available. And we did it. And we recorded it with Oliver Lieber, who's the son of a very famous artist, and a guy called John Shanks, which the band have worked with since, another producer. And they had a different twist on it. And then I wrote the violin line in the studio, and they were like you know, when the Americans hear the Irish thing, they're like, oh my God, what's that? I love it, you know, because it just became rootsy all of a sudden. And then that was the first thing that sort of just started to get play properly on radio. However, before then, we'd kind of hit it big in Australia with Forgiven Not Forgotten.
I loved as well, isn't it true? Because you'd been pretty broke living in a house together and you were saying it was full of spiders or something. I read that. And then when you finally did make it, you and Andrea, I think you went shopping in Harvey Nicks.
Oh, yeah.
In London.
Yeah, it's like, well, our house, our actual family home was perfect and Mum and Dad kept it great. Jim had his a rented, what was it, lodge at the end of, you know, like a farm or whatever. And it was just riddled in damp and spiders. And, you know, we had the egg cartons on the wall for soundproofing. I mean, it was as basic as you get. Manky. But, you know, then cut to maybe 1998, 1999. It's Christmas time. We're never out of London. We're never out. We're just touring the world. We're playing like Wembley Arena 6 times in a row. And it's like, you know, it's like mind boggling. We were staying in the Mandarin Oriental in Knightsbridge, which is, again, it's like, hello, we're from Dundalk. And then I remember, you know, coming out of the Mandarin Oriental in London, and we never stopped working. So we had a day off and we were going in to buy Mum and Dad their Christmas presents. And I don't think I'd been in Harvey Nicks before. And we went in and everybody recognised us. And we were like, oh my God, this is mortifying. And then I remember buying Mum this like beautiful Donna Karan velvet sort of top and skirt for Christmas. Because this was the Christmas where we've treated them, you know. And just to be able to afford that stuff was greatly appreciated, unnecessary, but lovely to do for our parents. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
that sort
really
of thing
is.
Was
like
lovely.
Giving back to them.
It is, yeah.
And when you think back on those amazing days, you say like 6 days in a row at Wembley, and you are back together again now. Yeah. You're going to be touring again this year, which is wonderful. Yeah. Do you enjoy it more now than in the huge days or not? Is it different?
I think that I know personally I'm much more comfortable in my skin. I have a lot more confidence as an older woman. And I'm very proud of being an older woman. You know, in my 50s, 50s have been the best years of my life, I have to say. I think that there were so many times that I really enjoyed in the earlier days, but we didn't. Like, I remember saying to Andrea specifically the first day in Wembley Arena, I remember saying, I went up to her on stage and we were doing soundcheck. We were terrified. We were like deer in the headlights, you know. And I said to her, pinch yourself so you can remember this. Now we do things our own way. It's like, yeah, we're not doing any promo. And, you know, if we are doing promo, they're coming to the hotel. You know what I mean? And we have a good makeup artist. We have styling. So it's like you can get your sleep because you need it. We just toured New Zealand, Australia, Manila. We were in Manila and also Jakarta in November. We were out for a month and we had an absolute ball.
Because people still love all the songs.
They really do. And they're really glad that we've come back. And you know, I feel really, really privileged to do what I do.
And into every life. As you say, you're enjoying your 50s more than any other decade. Yeah. But including myself, like many people, you've had a broken marriage.
Yeah, yeah.
How was that? And are you much better now? Have you moved on from
that? Well, it's never fun. I mean, come on, you know that, Miriam. And I mean, I don't know anything about your history, but you've told me just that.
Yeah.
I guess a lot of my stuff was reported quite heavily in the newspapers via the other people involved, because I never had my private life in the newspapers. So it became news sort of, you know, via of the fact of who my ex had gotten involved with. But it wasn't the story of always is completely incorrect and it's nobody's business and I don't care to, you know, talk about it because it's like, do you know what I mean? Mm. It's just, you know. But I am, how would I say, I have learned so much from the storm of that, that I'm extremely grateful. Like it really, really pushed lessons in front of me that if I didn't learn, that I would either just stay on this a sort of like a safe fence or I'd, you know, get off and do something about it. And I got off and I did something about it. And I've, you know, taken my music career to different dimensions. As a woman, I love being single. I would say I'm probably one of the happiest divorced women on the planet. So I'm coming on, must be 6 years now. No, 5 years. And I'm delighted I did it.
Sharon Corr on Sunday with Miriam. Concerns have been raised over the low number of rental properties available to those who are in receipt of the Housing Assistance Programme, or HAP. Brian Dobson had more on this on today's News at One.
There were 38 properties within the HAP scheme available for rent last month, according to the latest Simon Communities Locked Out of the Market report. Sligo had the lowest number of any properties available, with just two across a three-day period in March. Mary Jemison is North West Manager with Focus Ireland.
We weren't surprised by that when we saw the report because we have an advice and information service that anybody can use to have help around. Typically, people come in and help around housing. They cannot find anywhere to rent that is either within HAP or affordable, and particularly in Sligo town. So we had 190 people between January and the end of March use that service. And that's about a 10% increase on the same time last year. So we're seeing people who are getting valid notice of terminations. They're looking and looking. Then they come to us because they can't find anywhere. They can't move out of the property that the landlord is selling. And it's very, very stressful for people when they're in that situation. And they come into us and we're looking on Daft. We're looking at myhome.ie. We're looking at shared houses, shared rooms in a house, all of that. And there's so little available for people. It's just extremely limited.
Now, have you noticed an increase in the number of terminations? Is that something that you think is increasing?
That certainly, we've noticed that over the past year. And I think it's just, it's individual landlords who might have inherited the family home or, you know, might just be one property, but they either want their own family in the home or they're selling just to get out of rent it. So there's very little movement. People who are in private rented apartments are staying in them. There's not a huge amount of allocations with the local authority. So there's very little movement for people in private rented.
Mary Jemison, Northwest Manager with Focus Ireland on the News at One. And the story was also covered on Morning Ireland. Mary Wilson spoke to Wayne Stanley, Executive Director of Simon Communities.
What is the state of the rental market for those in receipt of HAP payments in Ireland today?
Well, I think for the last number of reports, what we found is essentially we're at a functional zero. And what that means is, that's not to say that nobody is exiting homelessness or avoiding homelessness through the private rental market. Is still a very important part of our housing system. But what we're seeing is for those on low income who have availability to access the HAP payment, they're having to top up beyond what the local authority can provide them with from their own income. And our concern is that those properties, if they can secure them, are not sustainable because of the 100, 200, even 300 euros a month additionally they're having to pay.
They have to top up the top up.
Exactly.
So how much do they get? I know it varies depending on where you are, but how much are they getting? How much then do they get in an additional top up from local authorities? And then what have they to add to that to secure a home?
Well, as you say, it varies across local authorities. But to take one example, Cork, a couple with one child, the basic rate is 900 a month. That can be increased through the local authority up to a rate of 1,215 euros. Out of that, now the person will already pay 15% of their income towards that. And then they're having to top up anything up to 200 and 300 euros a month out of their own income to meet what the sort of rents that we're seeing.
And even at that, there is enormous difficulty in trying to secure a rental.
Yeah, and anyone who's engaged with the private rental market will tell you how hard it is to find a property. Landlords are leaving the market. There is people who have a property are staying in it. So we don't see the same level of churn. So when we look at the total number of properties, there was an increase in this quarter and there was just under 1,200 properties or just over 1,100. But if we go back to 2021, March 2021 was the period when we started to exit COVID. Mm-hmm. Was the period when we saw the lowest level of homelessness that we have in a long number of years. And the supply in the private rental market at that time was around 3,000 properties. And 28% of those properties in our snapshot were available to people using the maximum mm-hmm. discretion in HAP. That's now down to 3%. And that speaks to really the crisis that we have both in the mm. private rental market and for people who are on a low income.
There's no one factor in that decline, but to what do you attribute? You mentioned landlords leaving the market, but there are other factors as well. Is it the case that landlords may not want to rent to HAP tenants?
Well, what we're looking at here is, as I say, is the snapshot. So in terms of our report here, there isn't particularly, it doesn't find evidence for the changes in the market. It merely states what's there. But I think a big part of it has been the reduction in supply in the private rental market. And yes, there is there may be a reluctance on landlords to take a HAP payment. But the truth is, everyone is finding it difficult on any income to find a place in the private rental market.
You know, it's interesting you're saying from 2021 to where we are now, you have seen that significant reduction in the availability of property. Yeah. Something's changed.
Well, the big part in terms of the availability for HAP from the 28% to the 3% has been the ongoing increases in the cost of renting, particularly for people who are switching properties. Mm-hmm. I think the RTB produces regular data which shows that there's now a very significant gap between what somebody who's, you know, been in a property for a number of years and somebody who's trying to get into the private rental market will see. And it's when we're looking at it, we're obviously looking from the perspective of people who are trying to exit homelessness or who have their landlord is selling up or wants the property back and are having to engage with the private rental market to keep themselves out of homelessness. So that's the focus for the Simon Communities.
We'll talk about solutions in a moment, but for somebody who wants to, and you know, people want to get out of homelessness, HAP was a way through.
Absolutely.
Is it a way forward anymore?
In essence, part of the reason why we're seeing the month-on-month increases in homelessness to the scale that we are is because the private rental market is no longer the exit that it was. A number of years ago, back in 2021, maybe 60% of the families who were leaving homelessness were leaving through utilising the housing assistance payment, getting out into the private rental market. That number has now fallen off a cliff. It's a very small number. And local authorities, to be fair, a number of local authorities are stepping up and increasing their allocations to individuals and families to try and support them to bridge that gap. But they're just not able to. There isn't supply there to fully bridge that gap. Although we'd always call on them to try and do more, given the, I suppose, the trauma that's experienced by somebody having to stay in homelessness and the long-term impact of having to stay in homelessness for a period of time.
And yet, Wayne, you get a sense from within government that there is a feeling that the housing programme is delivering. Darragh O'Brien, you know, talking about delivery in the high 30s this year with a very positive trajectory. Simon Harris wanting to deliver something of the order of 50,000 homes a year. But what is the delivery like on social housing, on affordable housing, for the categories that you're talking about?
I suppose, I mean, the delivery of social housing to a multitude of different schemes is increasing, but where we are, forgive me now, I'm going from memory, mm-hmm. but there's about 7,000 houses delivered. We believe that needs to be closer to 15,000. If you look at the housing agency produces an annual report looking at housing need, essentially the number of people who've applied for social housing, there's about 15,000 or 14,000 households joining the social housing waiting list each year.
And not a corresponding number leaving.
Exactly. Okay. So if we had 15,000, that would give local authorities enough room to meet ongoing demand and also to start to draw people out of the private rental market and freeing up space for everybody there.
Wayne Stanley, Executive Director of Simon Communities, speaking to Mary Wilson on Morning Ireland. They were once known as granny trolleys, but Claire Byrne was discussing the joy of shopping trolleys and their newfound popularity among younger people.
But a new generation of younger shoppers are discovering the joy, the convenience, the retro chic of these long shopping bags on wheels. And for more on this trend, I'm joined by retail consultant Barry Savage. Good morning, Barry.
Good morning, Claire. How are you today?
I'm very well. I'm delighted about this because I wanted to buy one of these a few years ago, but my children stopped me and they will not stop me now because they're back.
I thought you had one.
Back on trend. I should have one. Will you just describe, because I want to make sure people know exactly what we're talking about here. Describe it for us.
Yeah, well, basically what it is, Claire, it's like a large shopping sort of a basket or a container on wheels. Now, you can have it on two wheels or you can have it on four wheels. The two-wheel one is sort of generally dragged behind you. And the four-wheel one is on these swivelly wheels that you push in front. A bit like the suitcases that you'd have in the airport.
Mm-hmm. That's the one you have, isn't it?
Oh, that's the one I have. Claire, is I have a foldy-uppy one, which I put into the back of my EV, which we're talking about earlier. It's not a chargeable one, but there are chargeable ones as well that are battery operated that will give you a bit of a boost when you're going up the hill or whatever. Mm-hmm. You can press a handle on it. But there are various different styles. And that's basically what they are. It's a huge convenience.
And in your experience in the retail industry, traditionally they might have been used by older people. That's why they have this awful pejorative name of granny trolley, don't they?
Dreadful name on it, yeah. And in the States, they're called a granny cart. You know, you go to get your granny cart and go down to the store with it. Yeah, absolutely. It's a dreadful pejorative term, so it is. But that's changing as well. The only people you would have seen would be generally older people, men and women. But indeed, you'd see them down around the forecourts in Dublin. You'd see, like, our learned friends pushing their documents around them.
Yeah.
So it's not just grannies and barristers that are using them.
They make such sense. They make such logical sense. If you think about it for a second, who wants to be throwing the bag up on your shoulder? I mean, we have our physiotherapist in here with us telling us how bad that is for us when you can pull your groceries behind you.
Absolutely. You see, this is the thing. And this is one of the reasons why younger people, I think, are using them now as well. Because, younger people would look at the evidence, and the evidence is, as you said, they're sustainable, they're environmentally friendly, they're very, very good for your back and shoulders. They get you walking straighter when you're pushing them or pulling them, and it gets you out of the house, and it gets you, it's a much more sociable thing. There should be a grant, sir, there should be,
now
for people to use them.
In London, of course, and you've worked in London in retail as well, the trendy people have been using them for years there, haven't they?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You see, my first many, many years ago, my training, Claire, up in Sainsbury's in North London, in Islington. And it was just around the time that Islington was becoming very, very trendy.
Mm.
That's naturally because why I was living there. But there was a new store opening, one of these huge big stores that opened. I was involved in the fit out of the store, but I used to love actually spending time in the shop floor, and that was one of the first time you'd see people coming in. But also, I've never seen anything like it. I was used to seeing the older granny type trolleys or older people pushing them around Dublin, but you see absolutely young trendy people with tattoos and all, and even had tattoos on the carts, on the trolley carts as well. All sorts of really very well accessorized.
Mm-hmm.
Even some of them with political slogans on them.
Yeah, so they're personalised, they're fashionable.
Absolutely.
I mean, Gucci are rolling one out now, if you'll pardon the pun, aren't they?
They certainly are. Gucci have one out, and I think it's, and Chanel have one out. Chanel have just launched a sort of a quilted one, leather trolley. Which is, I mean, it costs something like 6,000 or 7,000 euro or something. I mean, obviously, you wouldn't be advocating that. And Lobo 10 even has a special edition one out as well, probably with a red bottom on it. But anyway, that's where it's got to. But they are becoming, well, as I say, I think it's the environmental aspect of them as well, the fact that they're sustainable. But you don't have to use bags or anything. So push it down to your local store.
People put all sorts of things in them, don't they, though?
Oh, sure, look at Claire. But this is the thing. I remember, again, getting back to my time in London. Security came to me in the shop floor one day and said there was a man in the store and he was balancing his shopping basket on top of the trolley. And every now and again, he actually had a packet of sausages. And there's no word of a lie. A packet of sausages in the basket. And he'd open the packet, lift up the lid of the trolley and throw it into the cart. I was like, what the hell is going on here? I'm telling you. What the hell is going on? So security wanted to have him barred. And I said, no, look, you leave it to me. I'll go over to him. So I went over and said, excuse me, sir. He goes, yes. He says, I just saw you with the sausages there and you're throwing them into the cart. I said, you know, you may get yourself into trouble doing this. Oh, he says, just have a look. So he lifted up the lid. And I swear to God, on the bottom of the trolley was an adorable little white Yorkshire terrier.
Was it that little if he was feeding it sausages?
Yes, feeding sausages. He says, this is Twinkle. I said, oh, Twinkle. He said, well, my name is Barry. He said, all right, Baz. He said, meet Twinkle.
Right.
And I said, oh, hello, Twinkle. How are you doing? So, and at the back of the toy, he said, well, I said, the dog all right there at the bottom of that car? Oh, he says, look at the back there, Baz. And he said, there was a grill on the back of the trolley where air could get into the dog.
Lovely.
So he gets, and he said, you know, he says, I'll get out of the house. He says, here in North London, I live in North London, get out of the house. I said, I do my shopping. It gets me down to the shop. He says, really nice to meet you, Baz. He said, you're not going to bawl me, are you? I said, I won't. No, I won't.
But sure, he was planning on paying for the sausages, was he?
Oh, yeah, no, he paid. Oh, absolutely. He go to the checkout.
With the empty packet.
For the empty packet.
Yeah.
And he said, his name, I always remember him. I often wonder what happened to him. You know, his name was Nigel. Now, not your friend, Nigel. A different Nigel.
Not Nigel Farage. Wasn't Nigel Farage.
Nigel Farage wouldn't be feeding his dog. Well, not EU sausages anyway. But he, so that was one use for us. But it got this particular man, got Nigel out of the house. And I got to know him over the time I was there. And he went everywhere with his cart, with Twinkle in the bottom.
Well, listen, I think it makes great sense. We want people to shop local. We want people to leave the car behind. So, you know, this is the solution, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. No, it totally is. And, you know, as I said, you start off saying the old pejorative term is a granny cart. I mean, you know, if you go to the airport and look at the lovely flat terrazzo floors that they have at the airport and the trolleys that you just give a little nudge to and it glides majestically over the floor like a gazelle in the Serengeti. Well, it'd be the same thing in supermarkets at the same floors. The trolleys are the engineering aspects of the trolleys now are nearly like the suitcase. They're really hard, really easy to push. Everybody's using them. And why not?
Why not? Why not? Well, exactly. I'm going to tell my children now they need to get over themselves because they did stop me from buying one a few years ago. And they were very young at the time. I was surprised at their prejudices, but they said that they were for old people.
No, don't mind them, Claire. Don't mind. You tell them if they don't show up, you put one of them in the trolley and feed them sausages too.
Retail consultant Barry Savage on Today with Claire Byrne. And that's all we have time for on this edition of Playback Daily. So from me, Louise Herity, thanks for listening and take care.